Hello, welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. The usual ration, two guests today. First, in a moment, we'll hear from Lucia Green-Weiskel, a special advisor to the Innovation Center for Energy and Transportation, on the U.S.-China climate deal. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with avowed neoliberal Stephen Tellis, who will explain what his worldview has in common with people further to the left, and what it doesn't. I have no special wisdom to offer on Ferguson except to say this. The wave of protests, CNN counted 120 cities across the U.S. where they were happening, in reaction to the outrageous non-indictment, is inspiring. It's making me think that maybe Frances Fox Pippen was right when she said in this show a couple of years ago that Occupy marked the beginning of a long wave of transformative activism. From what I saw in New York, there's an inspiring union of Occupy veterans with mostly younger black activists. Here's to more of that. A couple of weeks ago, Barack Obama and Chinese President Xi Jinping announced a climate deal, which wasn't really a deal, that committed, without really committing, the two countries to a path of greenhouse gas reductions. What's it all mean? And what is China's climate policy anyway? To answer those questions, here's Lucia Green-Weiskel, who is a special advisor to the Innovation Center for Energy and Transportation, a think tank jointly based in Beijing and L.A. That U.S.-China climate deal, some people say it's a big thing, and others are saying it's just formalizing the status quo. What's your opinion?
Well, I think it's some of both. I think it is really a big deal, I think, especially politically. You know, this is really a departure for China to make a commitment on peak emissions. So China, just to get the details, committed to peaking its total carbon emissions by 2030, or the words are exactly around 2030. The U.S. also made an agreement as well that had to do with reductions. The U.S. has already peaked, so it's a different type of reduction. But it's two countries standing together, both making their own policies, you know, but they're not connected to each other. They're just sort of saying them at the same time. Really, it's not an agreement. It wasn't negotiated. It wasn't like Obama's people met with China's climate people and they were sort of working out numbers and, you know, moving back and forth on what they would agree on. Basically, it was just the two leaders standing side by side and making their agreement. So in terms of the upcoming talks in Lima at the COPs, this is really significant because it shows the two largest emitters, the U.S. and China, working together. That's been something that's been lacking in the past. So symbolically, this is a big change. And we'll see how that plays out at the summit. In terms of the actual content, you know, if you sort of look more, if you apply a little bit more scrutiny to the 2030 peak, it begins to look less and less ambitious. And so I think that's something that I've been a little bit concerned about. You know, for example, in just 2 years ago, The Guardian published an article in which it said, you know, basically if China does nothing other than what it's already doing, so kind of not a worst case scenario, but maybe one step up from a worst case scenario, if China doesn't add any new sort of ambitious or progressive policies, that China will continue to emit up until 2030. You know, so it's kind of characterizing the exact same statistic is kind of in kind of a bad way, framing in sort of a bad light. You know, there's various studies that have been passed around. The Lawrence Berkeley National Lab published a study in 2011, which called for a 2033 peak under continuous improvement scenario. So basically, these kind of numbers have been out for a long time. And even Zhang Gaoli, who came to the UN Climate Summit in September, basically said that China was going to make this announcement very soon. So it's actually not. It's not that surprising. I mean, people keep saying this sort of shocking new deal that came out. But in fact, what's shocking about it is that the two leaders stood side by side and actually said this. But the content of the deal, especially on the China side, is actually not that shocking. And in fact, you know, a lot of people are saying that China could do a lot better. You know, there's some evidence that internal studies within China are saying that China could easily peak by 2025. That in fact, it has the technological wherewithal, especially with projections on growth right now. You know, China is undergoing a state-orchestrated slowdown in growth. This is something that is drastically going to have, you know, impacts on greenhouse gas emissions in the next 5 to 10 years specifically, but then also beyond that. You know, I think projections are even saying that China may slow to something like 3 or 4% growth. Right now it's slowing from 10 to 9% rate that it's enjoyed in the last, you know, 10 years to something more like 7%. That's what's included in the 12th five-year plan. So, you know, so I think if you take all of that into consideration, and you take sort of the China's plans to replace a lot of the coal-fired power plants with synthetic gas and some other bringing new sources of renewable energy online, and very ambitious plans for development of nuclear energy and continued reliance on hydro energy. The 2030 peak becomes more and more of like a business as usual scenario.
2030, I mean, that's the better part of 20 years. Do we have that long?
Well, right, exactly. I mean, that's the other point is, you know, the two nations said that this deal was consistent with a long-term goal of keeping within the 2 degree Celsius rise from pre-industrial levels. And basically everybody who's looking at the numbers agrees that that's impossible. The window for opportunity is closing. I don't know. There's a lot of unknowns here, but certainly there's mounting and ample evidence that China needs to do more for this to actually have a real impact on climate change. And also, and this is where I'm more interested, is that China can do more. You know, it has the internal capacity to do more. So why isn't it? One thing that's missing in the 2030 peak goal that China set is what's going to happen to China's emissions after the 2030 peak. There's two different scenarios. One is that China's emissions will rise to 2030 and then will flatten out. And the other scenario is that China's emissions will rise until 2030 and then start to come down. And for the implications for global climate change between those two scenarios is very, very different. There's no indication in the agreement that was just released, which will happen. So I think that's a huge unknown and really has a huge impact on the overall, you know, effects of this goal.
Well, let's talk about this some, because, you know, a lot of right-wing skeptics of climate change or anthropogenic climate change play this kind of third-grade game. Oh, why do I have to clean my desk if Johnny hasn't cleaned his desk? And, you know, it's like China is the Johnny who hasn't cleaned his desk. Are the Chinese doing as little as, you know, the Republicans in Congress would say?
Well, no. I mean, they're just straight-up misinformed. I mean, China is doing a lot. And there's kind of this phenomenon that's happening in China where China is a leader on greenhouse gas emission reduction policies. You know, if you look across the board at sort of transportation and energy generation and green technology, China is really a leader on policies to reduce carbon emissions. So the Republicans basically just don't know what they're talking about. But then there's this other thing, and people get confused, and rightly so, is that, you know, China has been really reluctant to join any sort of agreement at the international level, you know, at the COPs, at the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, to sort of bring its own national plan, you know, within the context of the international agreement. So to make it legally binding, to make it subjected to, you know, perhaps international inspectors or whatever the UN might suggest as a way of sort of, you know, making sure that China actually keeps with its goal. So from the perspective of the United States, which really wants China to sign on to an agreement, China has been non-compliant. From China's point of view, they're saying, you know, the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change doesn't require developing countries. You know, it's very, the very convention itself has the words that, you know, countries should act with common but differentiated responsibilities, meaning developing countries, you know, are exempt from the agreements. And so China thinks that it's acting within the laws of the convention. The U.S. feels that it's not because it disagrees with the common but differentiated responsibility clause. But, you know, so we have this sort of disagreement that's broken down in these two talks.
China's classification as a developing country is, in some sense, technically correct, but it's also, it's not Uganda. It's an industrial juggernaut, perhaps the second largest economy in the world, depending on how you measure it. How should China be treated? Is that a fair way to treat China as a poor country, given its industrial power?
I think it is, but I also think it's changing. I mean, if you look at China's economy now, yes, it is the second largest economy by some measurements, as you indicated. But also, China is a huge country. It includes very poor regions, so regions in the south, regions in the west. And, you know, China is one of the only countries that still manufactures the plow. I mean, it's like, it definitely fits into the category of a developing country, I think, no matter how you cut it. But in terms of climate change, this is changing a little bit. I mean, in the last couple of months, a new report came out that said that actually China's per capita emissions are higher than some European countries. And so on a per capita, even China's bigness has kind of often been an excuse that it can use to not act on climate change, just saying that it has such a large population, so much of it is still in poverty, that that's the priority of China's policies, but that's kind of changing, and especially now we're seeing China having a per capita emissions that's higher than some European countries. So China the implications of that are that China really needs to take more responsibility. And I think it knows that. I think maybe that's part of the reason why Xi Jinping decided to make this public statement with Obama on climate change. Interestingly, and I'll just say this as an aside, that event got a lot of press in the U.S. And of course, Obama got a lot of criticism from the Republicans in Congress about it. But in China, the event was much less celebrated. And it's kind of interesting to wonder why. I mean, I think Xi Jinping has an idea that the people in China are less concerned with the climate change problem, the problem of greenhouse gas emissions, and more concerned with the problem of air pollution, especially in Beijing, Shanghai, Guangzhou, where the air is really unbreathable, and people are getting increasingly upset about it. And so I think, a lot of people in citizens in China were kind of like, why is Xi Jinping making this big statement and making this agreement with a foreign head of state, especially the United States, when really he should be focusing on the air pollution that's affecting Chinese citizens right here at home?
They're not unrelated, though, are they?
No, they're not unrelated at all. But I think there's a perception that climate change is more of a long-term problem, whereas the air pollution and the issue of particulate matter is more of an immediate problem and a domestic problem, and doesn't really involve the rest of the world. Of course, it does, I think, I would argue. But from the Chinese perspective, last spring, Beijing launched a what they call the war on air pollution, and I think that kind of policy is definitely more popular among Chinese people than, say, this 2030 peak policy.
What's the source of the horrendous air in the big cities?
Mostly coal. I mean, increasingly it's moving away from coal, and coal is burned in power plants, but also in homes for cooking, for heating. But more and more, a bigger slice of the pie is coming from transportation and cars on the road and pollution. So, coming from oil, and especially as the number of cars is going up and up, and especially in cities like Beijing and Shanghai, where you see the most air pollution. But interestingly, back to this war on air pollution, if you look at the pieces, it's sort of an 84-piece policy. It's got a lot of different parts to it, but some of the biggest parts of this policy are actually slashing production, so reducing the amount of energy that's being generated, and also taking cars off the road. So it's not relying on fancy technology or efficiency measures or anything like that. It's actually just sort of this crude measure of just getting rid of cars and cutting production. It's not sort of an advanced technology-based solution. And the war on air pollution is supposed to reduce coal consumption in Beijing by 50%. So it's a pretty dramatic measure. And I think if you consider that against, the 2030 peak, you can see how the 2030 peak is more and more possible.
What share of Chinese emissions, greenhouse emissions, is the result of production for export?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And that's something that comes up also in the UN. I think in 2004, there was a study done by somebody named Wang Tao, who at the time was at Sussex University, and he concluded that almost a quarter of China's greenhouse gas emissions can be directly sourced to products that are made for their export markets. There was another study in 2007 that said that number was closer to one-third, so growing. Now, China has passed a lot of stimulus packages. The domestic consumption in China is going up. So I think that will change. I think less of China's national carbon footprint will be sourced to, exports and more towards domestic consumption. But certainly that's been a big issue in the past, and I think continues to be an issue. I mean, a quarter of China's greenhouse gas emissions is equivalent to the entire annual emissions from a country like Russia. So at least in 2004, that was the case. So we're talking a huge number here.
I'm speaking with Lucia Green-Weiskill, a special advisor to the Innovation Center for Energy and Transportation, a think tank on environmental and climate issues jointly based in Beijing and L.A.
After the financial crisis hit China, you mentioned stimulus packages. They passed many stimulus packages and built a lot of high-speed rail. The figures on mileage were very impressive in a very short period of time. But has that had any effect on reducing the use of the internal combustion engine?
People had a lot of hope that having a real world-class public transportation system would convince people to not buy personal cars. And I remember when I first worked in China in 2002, I met with some transportation planners in Nanjing University, and they were drawing up plans to ban the personal car altogether. And I think that kind of planning is way long gone. I mean, that's just not happening at all. Cars are still very much a status symbol in China, and the transportation model is following almost exactly the American model. Highways is the main source of transportation, and also delivering goods across the country and to trade export sites and things like that. There was this idea that rail was going to be the future in China, and China has built a lot of high-speed rail for personal passengers, but not for freight. And freight is relying increasingly on highways, and there's just a lot of everything. So yes, there are some great new high-speed rails that are being laid down, but you know, there's also a lot of highways being built. And there was also a huge corruption scandal within the railroad department a couple of years ago. And so I think that put a real damper on hopes that that was going to be the new centerpiece of China's transportation.
What is China doing on renewables?
Well, the 2030 peak requires that China brings 800 to 1,000 gigawatts of new renewable energy online. So some of that will be solar, some of that will be wind, and some of that will be nuclear. Which China considers to be a renewable or a zero emission. They don't use the word renewable. They usually call it new energy or zero emission energy. You know, of course, we know that nuclear energy is not zero emission energy, but that's how China considers it in these numbers. So yeah, I think that we will see a continued escalation in wind and solar, and that's very good. I did report a while ago about some connectivity problems that China was seeing building wind and solar farms that ultimately were, you know, beautiful installations of reflecting the state-of-the-art technology, but they were having difficulty getting those facilities connected to the grid itself. And so they were just kind of standing there and not producing any energy. So that's something that China's had problems with in the past. I think some of those problems have been resolved more recently, but still that's a problem that's been facing renewable energy for a while.
You mentioned forthcoming UN climate talks. Give us the when and where and what on that.
Sure. Well, it'll be interesting to see what we see in Lima next month, and then, of course, Paris for the big 2015 talks next year. You know, this deal with this pact, I should say, between the U.S. and China definitely bodes well. I mean, I think it will put a lot of good pressure on the UN talks, but we'll see. I mean, China's position is a little bit unclear. China has traditionally stood with the G77 and with other negotiating blocs like the like-minded developing countries who have really stood in opposition to the United States. So I don't know how the other countries who are in those groups will see China's decision to make this deal with the U.S., whether or not that will be sort of an act of disloyalty. I'm not sure, you know, if that will have any diplomatic repercussions. We'll just have to wait and see on that. But I imagine we'll see a reiteration of China's pledge and nothing really much beyond that. One thing that I think will be very interesting is what will be in China's 13th five-year plan, which is due out next spring. It looks, from what we've heard from the top level of the Chinese Communist Party, it looks like this 2030 peak will be included in that plan, and with it, a lot of the details about how China plans to get there. And so when that plan is released, the 2030 peak becomes legally binding for China, not within the UN framework, but it becomes legally binding as a domestic plan. And also we'll be able to see a lot more transparently kind of the nuts and bolts of the plan. I think that will be interesting, but that's not going to be available for this upcoming talks in Lima. It will be available for the Paris talks.
How is China perceived in these international conferences? As a leader, as sort of something to itself, or what?
Well, not something to itself, but and not quite a leader, although, you know, within those two negotiating blocks that I mentioned, the G77 and then also the group called the Like-Minded Developing Country, which is a more fluid assembly of different nations who have split away from the G77 to form their own position and cohere basically around the common but differentiated responsibilities principle. Within that group, China is really seen as a leader, you know, as a very positive force in the talks, and as a country that within the tiers of development status, you know, that China is a developing country, but it's definitely one of the more wealthy developing countries. And as that, it is able to be in a position where it can provide technological and even in some cases financial assistance to other developing countries. So it's kind of like a big brother or a big sister, you know, within the developing country block. From the perspective of the developed countries, China has been seen as sort of at best not helpful and at worst sabotaging the talks, especially in Copenhagen in 2009. China was really seen as the cause for that round of talks failure. You know, that China's, as the largest emitter of greenhouse gases, was completely resistant to signing on to any deal that did include leadership from the developed world, you know, that caused the talks to sort of fragment, fall apart, and then ultimately completely fail. And then the next year in Cancun, I think, you know, China got a sort of PR makeover and discovered how to basically say the same, you know, policies but package them slightly differently so that China looked more positive. It was saying yes more often to things, and it was emphasizing what it was doing rather than what it wasn't doing. And that seemed to have worked. I mean, again, it was very much more symbolic than substantive, but China sort of had a character makeover. It kind of became a more positive player. It then started working more closely with the G77 and these other groups. And now that's why it'll be interesting to see how China is sort of presents itself in the talks now that it's working more closely with the United States.
And then finally, the U.S., of course, will be perceived strangely, because Obama will be a lame duck and the Congress will be in control of biblical literacy, but don't believe in global warming. So what's the U.S. role going to be?
Well, that's hard to say. I mean, I think this pledge of reducing 26% to 28% from 2005 levels is a good start for Obama. I don't know what he's planning to do about Congress and how this will become legally binding within the United States. So I think, yeah, I it's hard to say exactly how that will happen. I've been focusing more on the China side, so I don't know. But I do think that this agreement between the United States and China shows that Obama has come to a place where he recognizes Beijing's terms in a different way. I think when he first was addressing China in the climate change problem, he wasn't really aware of the historical context of kind of the issues that China is facing. You know, the fact that for it's a big deal for China that historically the U.S. has produced a lot more emissions than China. The per capita issue was big for China. The fact that the U.S. per capita emissions, you know, used to be something like 5 times China's per capita emissions. Now it's about 2 times China's per capita emissions. But, you know, this sort of historical and larger economic context was something that was really important for China. And Obama, or rather I should say the U.S. negotiating team, never really saw that. They never really acknowledged that. They never really recognized that. And also, you know, the export issue, the issue of kind of a lot of emissions, China's emissions coming from products that were made for export. You know, these were things that China saw as reasons to for China to be sort of exempt or at least have less responsibility within the UN context. But now I think Obama maybe is seeing more of that, or at least his people are telling him the right things, you know, so that he's saying what China wants to hear. And I think, you know, I don't have any evidence for that, but I think the fact that the two were able to come to this deal, to stand up together, shows that, you know, Xi Jinping really didn't have to do this. And I think the only reason why he must have done it is because Obama was able to communicate to the Chinese that his climate people have some understanding of China's situation.
I was Lucia Green-Weiskill, a special advisor to the Innovation Center for Energy and Transportation, a think tank on environmental and climate issues jointly based in Beijing and L.A. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Some of Brahms' Sonata for Two Pianos, first movement performed by Emanuel Ax and Yefim Bronfman. It's a transcription of his more famous piano quintet. Next up, Stephen Tellis. Tellis is an associate professor of political science at Johns Hopkins. He has a piece in the current issue of The Nation on Hillary and her inevitability, as do I and five other people. He's also an author of a long essay on what he calls Clodgeocracy, a cobbled-together system of governance in national affairs, which you can easily find on the web by searching for the word Clodgeocracy. Stephen Tellis. So how are you feeling about Hillary and her inevitability?
I feel empty and uninspired, which I think is not going to be an opinion that is rarely shared by others. So I have this piece in The Nation, which you also have. And I more or less say that Hillary Clinton is pretty much right in the middle of the Democratic Party. The idea that she's some sort of right-wing outlier is preposterous. She represents more or less where the party, and by the party I mean the large donors, but also the substantial interest groups in the party. She's more or less situated herself basically where they are. And so to criticize Hillary is to criticize more or less where the party is. And there's, again, a large range of issues in which I wish the party was somewhere other than where it is. I wish it was more open to shrinking the size of the financial sector. I wish it was more open to a substantial rethinking of at least substantial parts of the welfare state and how we do so much of it through subsidy and complicated tax policy, which is something probably your listeners are less sympathetic to, but I wish it was open to more broad scale forms of school choice. But those are all issues in which I and people who like me have not persuaded the party to be there. So our problem with Hillary is really a problem with the party.
Now, what makes you think she is so hostile to school choice? I mean, she seems very friendly with the Wall Street wing of the party, which is very pro education reform.
The evidence recently, again, I think over the last few months, is that both her and Bill Clinton seem to have become much more harshly critical of charter schools. Again, I have no idea what the reason for that is. Again, my basic suspicion is that, again, she's situating herself where the party is, right? Teachers unions are a very large part of the Democratic Party. They care much more about this than the financial sector does. That is, the financial sector puts a not trivial amount of its philanthropy into school choice, but that doesn't determine at the end of the day whether people have a job or whether they're going to be able to live in fancy parts of the suburbs of New York. And it matters a lot to teachers unions. So again, if you were assuming that Hillary Clinton was motivated only by finding where the absolute median of the intense demanders for policy in the Democratic Party were, that would pretty much explain why both her and her husband seem to have become less sympathetic.
Now, I don't want this to turn into a debate about school choice, but I do want to say that we have a lot in New York City. There's a lot of choice here. And the people who do the best by it are people with a lot of resources, financial and intellectual, and are able to do a lot of research and can work the system. How will that improve educational outcomes for people at the bottom who don't have those kinds of resources?
I mean, again, this is a complicated issue in which we've all been around and around for a while. I actually think New York school choice is a lot better than other places, partially because New York school choice is actually much better regulated than other parts of the country. Again, if you go to places like outside of New York and Massachusetts, you know, the regulatory regimes are often a little wild westy. But and so if you look at the overall evaluations of charter schools there, you know, I think on balance, moderately positive, but they're much more positive in places like New York and Massachusetts that have strong regulators who make sure that the worst schools end up getting flushed out. So I think, we partially have a disagreement. I think that for the people who get them, and again, controlling for background experience, I think well-regulated school choice systems like charter schools tend to be very good. But I think in those places, they're still facing substantial constraints on how large they are. So in some sense, it's a little bit of an irony to simultaneously say that they're only available for a small slice of people, and then also to simultaneously oppose increasing them. So I guess my opinion is that we ought to, in places with good regulatory systems, continue to push open the room for them. And again, in lots of places also, those schools don't have financial parity with district schools. And that also limits their ability and also means they end up having to do lots of fundraising, which they then get criticized for, which again is an irony.
Yes, well, then some of them have, you know, KIPP has some sizable financial advantages over many other rivals and conventional public schools. But I said I don't want to get this into a debate about school choice because that's a topic in itself. But you kind of, in your comments on Hillary, she is in many ways kind of, she and Bill together are responsible for the Democratic Party as it is today. They have bear a large portion of that responsibility of kind of pushing out the old New Deal social democratic wing of the party and introducing a whole lot of like mini initiatives, micro initiatives, little things, which kind of sound like, in your vocabulary, kind of like the kludges that you are criticizing as part of the kludgeocracy. Is she like too much an embodiment of that kludgeocracy?
Well, again, that was part of Bill Clinton's supposed political genius, was to get the Democratic Party away from the idea of big government. And Bill Clinton, after he lost Congress, began to push again across a lot of areas for various kinds of tax subsidies under the rubric of what was called then steering rather than rowing. I think you might remember that famous phrase of David Osborne's. And again, I was a New Democrat back then, although a fairly young one. I'm still in graduate school back then. And this was supposedly supposed to signal that the Democratic Party was not like those old new left type people. But I think the consequence of it is that we've actually gotten away from the ability to make straightforward arguments for government or on the other hand, straightforward arguments against having government in a particular area. Because government, under what I call kludgeocracy, has sort of metastasized to being involved in a kind of often niggling way everywhere, but without the actual power to genuinely transform social outcomes in a substantial way. And again, this is not just the Clintons. I think it goes much further back. If you look at, for example, the change in how we do retirement, going back to the 1970s, very late 1970s and early 80s, we started to gradually increase defined contribution pensions through things like 401ks and IRAs. And the idea was, well, this was going to really allow individuals to get a lot more access to the financial markets, and that was going to solve all our problems of retirement. And this would happen if we just subsidized and provided tax relief and maybe some regulatory interventions here and there. And I think the result is pretty much that our retirement system is collapsing, especially for those at the bottom. A simple direct increase in Social Security would be much better than the entire panoply of things we're trying to do in retirement. Again, you see almost all one of the biggest fads now is the idea of all these sort of automatic sign-up things in 401ks. But the real question is, why are we trying to solve this major social problem of retirement income through all of these sort of backward, back-flipping, complicated measures when we have a perfectly simple way to just adjust the level of retirement benefits in Social Security and call it a day? And we can sweep away all those regulations, all of that, and basically leave the financial markets just to the experts.
Well, but one of the reasons, of course, is that people like Bill Clinton were trying to get away from big government, so we're going to do all these like clever private sector solutions in which the government was, you know, steering or nudging or using these behavioral economic incentives or disincentives. This was, you know, seemed very clever 20 years ago. Now it seems like a big mess.
Yeah, well, I think part of the reason for the increase in all this is, you know, that people like me, both academics and think tank people, you know, straight up, social insurance is not a very sexy way to be solving social problems. If you're trying to establish yourself as an interesting, clever, analyst, trying to figure out some way that you can get leverage, the way you can somehow get government to get $2 in benefits for $1 of actual governmental intervention is going to sound like a much more clever way to make your name. And again, it's also not an accident that this is the period in which we've been squeezing down on one instrument of government, which is taxing and spending. And part of the argument I make in the Kleptocracy essay is that when you squeeze down on that one lever, the demand for government doesn't disappear. Right. We've basically created a supply constraint on taxing and spending, and that demand for government has metastasized into other areas. It's metastasized into regulation, into the tax code, into litigation, into all these sort of behavioral nudging interventions. Because again, in a democratic system, demand finds supply. But that supply is not necessarily nearly as good as the supply you would get through straight up taxing and spending, whether you're talking about the actual efficiency or the intervention. But for me, just as important, the democratic accountability of the intervention. The advantage of taxing and spending is it's all right there in the government books, right? But when you try and do things through various different complicated private nudging, you have a hard time tracking it, and you also have a hard time tracking who benefits from all those interventions, because those are much more easily manipulable by interest groups and other concentrated interests.
Well, not coincidentally, Wall Street people love those sorts of 401ks and things like that. And they do not like the idea of expanding Social Security. So this certainly is something that the policy pundits would like to sell, but it's also something that Wall Street wants to sell.
Yeah, although I've always been slightly less convinced by that argument where 401ks are concerned. Now, I think where 401ks and IRAs are concerned, it's certainly the case that Wall Street has loved them because they provide very large, a huge pool of savings. And since they're tax subsidized, people are probably less sensitive to the cost, and there's been less politicization of the cost in 401ks. The thing that always interested me, though, is that Wall Street was not as enthusiastic as you would think about Social Security privatization. And part of that is because they have a good thing going in 401ks and IRAs. And they were worried they were going to blow it if they had to provide asset management to everybody with a tiny account. So I think that sort of conspiracy story about what was going on with Social Security privatization was wrong. But I think it's certainly the case that they've been very happy with the idea of a purely voluntary system on which they can extract huge amounts of rents.
I'm speaking with Stephen Tellis, who teaches politics at Johns Hopkins. Now, of course, one of the mega kludges is our housing system, which we spend indirectly, mostly through tax subsidies or tax breaks, enormous amounts of money subsidizing housing, mainly at the high end, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, the complicated interventions we have in housing, which are almost always contradictory, right? The idea of most of our housing regimes are supposed to make homeownership more available, or at least make homeowning or at least having a place to live less expensive. But on the one hand, through all kinds of regulations, we make it hard to build in cities where people want to live. That drives up the cost of housing. And our subsidies drive up the cost of housing, right? Because all they do is they get capitalized into the price of the house that people built. That drives up the cost. You know, it makes it easier for the person who's buying the house, but everybody else who's trying to get in the market end up making it more expensive. So I think certainly that's the case where all of our complicated efforts to try to actually make homeownership less expensive or more available have pretty much been perverse, and it's the complicated nature of them that's pretty much directly to blame.
Part of the reason this is that we have this habit of layering new programs on top of existing programs, never starting from scratch.
Right. And again, part of that is a result of our institutional arrangements, right? I mean, we have a system of separation of powers. And one of the ironies I mentioned in that Kleptocracy essay is that there's a good argument that separation of powers constrains government on the way up, that, again, it has to pass through all of that, those different checks and balances in order to pass something new. But once you already have government in some areas, separation of powers makes it harder on the way down. And it means that it's harder to eliminate any program that's built up an interest group environment around it. And the consequence is, therefore, that we end up doing whatever new interventions of government by layering things on top of one another. So, again, Obamacare is a perfect example of that. I supported Obamacare, not, you know, with huge enthusiasm, but it's better than anything else that could get through this complicated system of interest groups who already had deep investments in various parts of the healthcare system and our system of separation of powers and the filibuster. When you add all that up, you kind of have Obamacare is what you're left with. But Obamacare is a pretty good example of kleptocracy and the kinds of compromises that people who, you know, I think people of goodwill who really want to do something and want to actually increase, in this case, access to health insurance, the kind of compromises that they're left with.
We're also operating through this federal system, which means, you know, in the case of Obamacare, we have state involvement with Medicaid, federal involvement all over the place. There's nothing coherent about this system.
No, and again, I mean, part of that is that we do have a sense that it's somehow less violative of our constitutional norms to do things by having the federal government shovel out money and give it to states. I think this creates a kind of perverse form of federalism where we don't have a real clean division between what states are doing and where states can reasonably be expected to compete against one another in straight up competition for people and businesses and what the federal government's doing. That is, I think there's a good argument. The federal government pretty much ought to own the entire space of health insurance and not have leave any room for the states to be involved at all, and ought to probably get out of a lot of things that it's doing by subsidizing and regulating. States should legitimately be left to their own devices. I think crime is a good example of that. Prisons, that's an area where actually federal subsidy has probably played a role of increasing mass incarceration by not forcing states to actually bear the entire cost of building all the prisons that they built. So I would be tempted to basically say that we ought to leave that entirely to states and get the federal government out as much as it can from that.
From what you say and what you write in the piece, it sounds like you should be an enthusiastic proponent of a single-payer system in an ideal world. Are we just so sure of the ideal world that it's impossible to conceive of that happening?
Yeah, I'm pretty close to being sympathetic to single-payer, as was actually the conservative Aaron Woldofsky, which something people don't quite realize, and for reasons that are pretty close to mine, which is that you ought to have focused responsibility. That is, whenever you combine the federal government with states, with private providers, all that complicated layer just leads people to try and find ways to pass on the cost to somebody else. And putting it straight up on the government's books is pretty much the only way to actually avoid that effort to keep passing along the hot potato. And I think there's a lesson for that in general. That is, people who consider themselves liberals or like you on the left ought to either help build a sufficient coalition to really get government in and to sort of occupy a particular space, or we shouldn't be getting involved at all. It's all those middle ground things that create the greatest possibilities both for rent seeking and for spiraling costs.
Of course, we've seen over the last decade or so increasing federal involvement in education, first through Bush's No Child Left Behind and then Obama's race to the top. What do you think of the policy structure that this has produced?
Even then, the federal government's role in education is very minor, right? Its role in charter schools is very small. Very little of the money that's going to charter schools is coming through the federal government at all. I actually think most of the complicated layers of regulation and subsidy that are embedded in the Department of Education are pretty much useless. I'm not terribly sympathetic to it. So, you know, again, if we were thinking about making a big grand bargain where, again, if that was the kind of thing governments did, and people like me often talk about that as if that was a thing that was actually on the menu and the government had the ability to make those trade-offs. But if there was, I would be perfectly happy to have the government occupy the healthcare space, the federal government occupy the healthcare space, and more or less get out of the education space.
If we look at the structure of the American system, with the states playing such a large role, and then, of course, the three branches of government meant to check and balance each other, are we really just structurally doomed to kleptocracy, or is there a way out of it?
I think that there's a lot institutionally that biases us toward kleptocracy. To some degree, it's a feature of mature democracy. That is, any mature democracy is going to have some of this, right? Because you're going to have existing programs. They're all going to build up supporting interest groups around them. And it's going to be easier to layer on top than to try and attack directly any of those well-defended structures, right? So just that fact of democracy, independent of separation of powers, is going to create a certain bias toward government complexity. But certainly our institutional system does that. I think at a minimum, we ought to make our go back in a way to having our government be no more majoritarian, more excessive than majorities than the actual Constitution has. If you go back in the Constitution, it would suggest the Senate should be a majority institution, the House should be a majority institution. But the idea of having a filibuster, I think, is very responsible for lots of the kleptocracy we see. So that would be the first thing, would be at least to have our institutions themselves have to be majoritarian. I do think, though, that this suggests that we really ought to be able to have a conversation about whether fundamental hardwired features of our Constitution have become problematic, especially in an era in which we have a very different party system than the founders imagined. And we ought to be able to have that conversation without people thinking that the people who are making the suggestion are strange, out-of-control nuts. I remember when Sandy Levinson, a good friend of mine, was first making this argument that we ought to be fundamentally rethinking the entire structure of the Constitution. A lot of people thought he was sort of crazy. I wonder how many people still believe that, having seen how the government has governed over the last few years.
The Constitution in some circles is in the status of almost a sacred text.
Yeah, and again, the big problem there is part of our Constitution was parties of a non-parliamentary kind. And I think even people who think that the Constitution should have a kind of sacred quality have to recognize that our constitutional system, which is different than the particular institutional features, is not operating at all the way that the founders expected. And I think it's more important to actually try and take some inspiration from the way that Madison and Hamilton thought about the organization of politics than to fetishize the particular arrangements that they created, which no longer operate the way that I think they intended. So I think that's the – and again, the other fact is we do have big government now, and we need a government that has sufficient planning capacity to actually operate a big government, whether some people want it or not.
Oh, Rand Paul will fix that, though.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, as soon as we get to 2017, and we end up moving off to a boat off the shore of Greece to avoid the Rand Paul Cadillo.
Finally, you I see you self-identify as a neoliberal. I'm not sure, do you do that to tweak people, or is there something? You sound not unreasonable to me. I wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't embrace you wholesale, but you seem not unreasonable, and a fellow one could have a serious and interesting conversation with. What is the essence of this neoliberalism by which you identify?
Well, I actually despise the phrase neoliberalism. I use it, again, to tweak people or you know, in the way that famously Irving Kristol was called a neoconservative and it was intended as an epithet, and eventually he just embraced it. I'm starting to wonder whether I should just embrace it. It's a phrase that's often used in academia to describe pretty much everything one doesn't like as a kind of spectral force that's behind everything malignant or evil. Part of it is, again, I think I'm more sympathetic to the idea of markets, of competition. I like entrepreneurship. I like the idea of a economy that has lots of areas for market entry. And I think the scope of government, I'm for constraining. I want government to do a few really big things, and I'd rather it avoid especially a lot of the kind of social paternalism that, you know, of course, New York has seen its fair share of over the last few years. So I think when you combine those things, that makes me, and again, on things like school choice, I'm very open to the idea of having, you know, the government have a big social insurance role, which I think is its most important role. And I would actually like to make that social insurance role even more general by taking the funding of education out of local property taxes and putting it on the highest possible source of, or the largest possible source. So I think those are all things you could legitimately call me a neoliberal, if that was a term that you had a taste for. But I think one of the lessons is that there isn't necessarily as much conflict between what some people who consider themselves to be on the left and those of us who consider themselves to be liberal, especially if we get past some of the arguments we've had in the past. The idea that our financial sector is too large, I think, is something where there should be a lot of agreement between people on the left and people who consider themselves liberals like me. I think especially if you start thinking about school choice in the context of being more redistributive than it is now and getting away from property taxes, that ought to be something that people on the left and liberals may be able to agree about. And I also think about the idea that we ought to have an economy that's more entrepreneurial and less biased toward incumbents ought to be something that people on the left and liberals should be able to at least come to some agreement about.
I'm Stephen Tellis, an associate professor of political science at Johns Hopkins. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Get Back by Laibach. Only Beatles you'll ever hear on this show. Till next week. Bye. You left me.